From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his deputy, Rod Rosenstein, today are interviewing candidates to replace FBI Director James Comey after his dramatic firing by President Trump yesterday. Comey, of course, was investigating possible Trump campaign ties to Russian election hackers. Critics are calling this moment Nixonian. Nixon firing a special prosecutor who is getting too close to uncovering Nixon's cover-up of a campaign dirty trick. But Vice President Mike Pence today told reporters that this firing by Trump was the right move at the right time.
And I'm very confident that the president will go through a process and he will choose an individual who will be able to lead the FBI not only back to credibility, to restore the trust and confidence of the American people, but lead the FBI to even greater heights to ensure that it does its job enforcing our laws and protecting our country.
Sir, when did you become aware that the Deputy Attorney General was conducting a review?
And with that question about Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who advised Trump to fire Comey hanging, Pence walked away from the microphones. And that's a question that New York Times reporter Julie Hirschfeld Davis has been looking into. She's still digging. We've got her by phone. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And your words jumped out today from the paper. You write, administration aides say that this firing had been in the works for at least a week, that officials at the White House and the Justice Department were told to build a case to justify the firing, and that AG Jeff Sessions was tasked with reasons to come up with for the firing. Was all of this, this tasking by Donald Trump?
Well, yes. I mean, we do know that this had been in the works for more than just a day. And obviously, the timing of it came as a surprise. But if you look at the way this relationship has unfolded over the past year and really over the last few months, you could see this dynamic building where it was clear that President Trump was not comfortable with having Comey in this position. And the real question now is, what was the final straw? What was the precipitating factor that finally led him to conclude that he needed to fire him, and that sort of motivated this whole process of reverse engineering a rationale that was what we saw with that Rosenstein letter that came out last night.
Well, you have Comey's exoneration of the Clinton emails during the election. By the way, and we were recently learning those questionable emails are only about a dozen, not hundreds of thousands, as Comey said. He also didn't back Donald Trump on Trump's claim of being wiretapped by Obama. But what was the straw that broke the back?
Well, listen, this is a president we know who prizes loyalty. He does not like to be questioned. He particularly does not like and has been really enraged by the notion that he didn't earn his electoral win, that it might have been handed to him either by Russia's meddling in the election or by Jim Comey's handling of the email investigation, which we know his opponent, Hillary Clinton, has blamed for her loss, and people around her believe played a big role. So he has not liked that storyline from the beginning, but he was particularly determined to have some sort of proof backing up those tweets from March in which he accused President Barack Obama of having spied on him or tapped his phones at Trump Tower. And Jim Comey made it clear very soon thereafter that he had no such corroboration and he was not willing to back up that charge. He had no evidence to do that.
But Julie, I'm sorry to interrupt, but your writing, it seems to make it clear that in fact, this has been something that's building for a while and may not have anything to do with the Russian investigation, but this simmering rage. And we're reminded that Trump's meeting today with Russia's ambassador and foreign minister, this is completely overshadowed by the firing. The American media wasn't let into this meeting. Russian media did. They took pictures of Donald Trump smiling with these Russian officials.
That's right. That was the Russian Foreign Ministry that posted those pictures. That was our first indication that the meeting had actually happened.
Right. But that's why many people feel that he fired Comey because of his friendliness with the Russians. In the few seconds we have, it sounds like you're saying this has been going on for a long time and a long simmering anger.
Well, there has been a long simmering anger, but I think that the issue now is it's quite clear that at least part of this had to do with Mr. Comey's participation in this investigation into Mr. Trump's campaign's potential ties with Russia. And to blame it all on Hillary Clinton, which is what the letter from Mr. Rosenstein does, just doesn't seem to pass the smell test. If he had a huge problem with how Jim Comey had handled that, then why didn't he fire him weeks and even months ago?
And why did he ask people to come? And why did he ask people to come up with reasons? I mean, to task them.
Exactly.
Julie Hirschfeld Davis, who covers the White House for the New York Times. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
And let's turn now to NPR's Jeff Bennett, who covers Congress for NPR. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. And Trump, as we just heard, had this previously scheduled meeting with the Russian foreign minister today in the Oval Office. Let's listen to a little clip of reporters peppering Trump with questions.
Why did you fire Director Comey? Why did you fire Director Comey?
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
Excuse me?
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
Not at all was Trump's answer on that. How is all this going down on Capitol Hill?
Well, there is still a sense of shock and alarm among lawmakers of all stripes, Jeremy. I mean, almost immediately, Democrats came out and were unequivocal in calling for a special prosecutor to pick up the FBI investigation into Russia's election meddling and the potential ties to the Trump campaign. Some really going as far to say no new FBI director should be confirmed until a special prosecutor is appointed. And Democrats particularly say the timing of Comey's firing is suspicious at best. And Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer this morning on the Senate floor pointed to what he characterized as a troubling pattern of events, namely the president's firing of Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, the firing of the U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara of New York, who had purview over Trump's New York business dealings.
One of the 50 U.S. attorneys who were all fired at the same time.
That's right. And then the decision by the Attorney General Jeff Sessions to recuse himself from the investigation after failing to disclose to the Senate Judiciary Committee some time ago during his confirmation hearing that he had twice spoken with the Russian ambassador. But, you know, here's the interesting thing. I spoke with a Democratic aide who said that they were very careful during the confirmation hearing for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who now is at the center of this whole thing. They were very careful to get him on the record saying he would recommend appointing a special prosecutor if the circumstances demanded it. Fast forward to today on the Senate floor, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer read a partial transcript of that exchange on the Senate floor and then said if there was ever a time when circumstances warranted a special prosecutor, it's right now. It's not, frankly, just Democrats who want that. Some more independent-minded Republicans are also concerned about the timing and the rationale for Trump's dismissal of Comey, including Senator John McCain, who this morning told reporters he didn't buy the Clinton email explanation. He didn't think it was a sufficient rationale. And he said that he deeply regretted the fact that Comey was dismissed.
So what does it take to actually get to a special prosecutor if you've got even some Republicans saying that that's the right idea?
Well, it would have to either be approved by Congress or be appointed by the attorney general. In this case, it would be the deputy AG, since the attorney general recused himself. But, you know, it's a good question you ask, because at this point, all we have right now are words from lawmakers. We have tweets. We have carefully crafted statements. We have lawmakers running to TV cameras to do cable TV news hits. We have not seen any real, beyond that, any sort of real pressure, any sort of real steps to move toward next steps. And frankly, as we said before, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has rejected this idea of having a special prosecutor. He's rejected it entirely out of hand.
There's a lot of reporting today, Jeff, about James Comey asking for more resources in the days leading up to his firing to investigate the Trump-Russia connections. Can you tell us anything more about that?
Well, my colleague Mary Louise Kelly, who covers national security issues for NPR, has confirmed that. There is this question of significant, which, because the person that she got on the record to confirm this says he didn't know how much money or how many resources Comey was asking for. But it adds a significant context to this, to the timing, particularly among those who do not buy the pretext that the Trump White House is giving for the president's reasoning in firing Comey in the first place. Tim Kaine this morning, Senator Tim Kaine, referred to that letter that Donald Trump sent to the former attorney general, or excuse me, FBI director, and said, he basically said that the section in there where that Trump said, you've told me three times that I was not part of the Russian investigation, he referred to that as Trump's tell and said he was a deeply insecure president who frankly understands that the noose is tightening because of this Russia investigation. Mm. So this idea that this all comes as Comey was asking for more money to continue this investigation is particularly suspicious.
Now we know
to
that
those people who find it so.
We know that Attorney General Sessions and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein are meeting today with people who may become the interim FBI director. Do we know who's being considered for the job?
Four candidates, all of whom are men. They come from the intelligence community. A couple of them work in the senior ranks of the FBI. I understand the announcement could come in the next couple of days. Not clear exactly when the announcement will come or, frankly, how long it will take for the Senate to consider the nominations. But in speaking with some Republican staffers, they say whoever the president decides on to hold this position will have to be someone who's unimpeachable and frankly, as apolitical as you can get, because Republicans who will effectively have to vote on this confirmation are very aware that their careers will last a lot longer than Donald Trump will be in office.
Hmm. And worth pointing out also that Attorney General Sessions had recused himself from the investigations into the Trump campaign in Russia, and he's the person who's, you know, one of two interviewing potential replacements for Comey. So we'll have to take that up at another time. But Jeff Bennett, covers Congress for NPR. Thank you.
Sure thing.
All this week, we're talking about privatization in America. Today, the military. At times during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, private defense contractors hired by the Pentagon have outnumbered U.S. troops on the ground. Demand for military contractors surged with those wars, and the U.S. military has come to depend on them. But what impact has the boom in private defense contractors had on our military? Joining us now is Molly Dunnigan, who's an associate director of the Defense and Political Sciences Department at RAND. Molly, welcome. And first of all, how long has privatization of the military been around?
So this is actually a phenomenon that has been around for thousands and thousands of years. Hmm. The oldest recorded use of mercenaries in war was in 2094 BC. It was more a norm to see private forces for the majority of the time since that period than it was to see state-run forces. It really actually took up until the end of the French Revolution, so 1815, for there to actually be more of a development of state-run militaries that were the basic standard. So really, up until about 2003, that was the norm.
Mm. And a big uptick in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, right?
Yes. So we saw a little bit in the Gulf War and Desert Storm, the first Gulf War. We saw a slight increase in the use of contractors, mainly for base operations, support and maintenance in the Balkans in the late 90s. But then, yes, in 2003, we saw a huge ballooning of the industry, primarily in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. That has since declined somewhat with the drawdown of forces in both theaters, but majorly really sort of changed the industry. And I think for the most part, some of those things are here to stay now.
And what's the advantage? What is the case that is made when the government decides, you know what, instead of doing this in-house, we're going to outsource it?
Sure. So there are several things. The first is flexibility. Contractors can be called upon fairly quickly and have forces ready to go that are trained and equipped for the most part. And then the second is that they're force multipliers, so they can easily add more boots on the ground. It depends on the theater and the status of forces agreement that they have in that theater, but sometimes contractors can also get around force management levels. So there are certain caps put on the number of military boots on the ground in theater, but not necessarily on Department of Defense civilians or contractors. And so you can actually add more bodies to your force without actually reaching that limit.
Now, accountability is a big issue when it comes to contractors. And one incident stands out. In September 2007, Blackwater private security contractors killed 17 unarmed civilians and wounded 24 others in Baghdad in Iraq. What happened there and how much did it have to do with the fact that it was a contractor? And did it change anything about oversight?
Great question. It's still a little bit unclear what happened there. There's a lot of what we call the fog of war surrounding that incident. Essentially, they were in a traffic circle in Baghdad. These were security contractors that were working on a diplomatic contract for the Department of State, and so they were protecting diplomats. They were in a convoy, so they were traveling through this traffic circle in Nisr Square. And it appears that a civilian, Iraqi civilian car had started to move. They weren't sure if it was an insurgent or not. It all of a sudden just escalated so that shots were fired amongst a number of civilian vehicles. And as you know, many were killed and many more were injured. It did change the level of accountability somewhat in that this was the first case that was successfully tried in the U.S. for contractors using the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. This is a U.S. domestic law that was passed in 2000 to try contractors working on overseas bases. But because these were U.S. citizen contractors, they were able to be tried under that act, and they were convicted. And so that does set somewhat of a precedent for utilizing U.S. domestic law to hold contractors accountable. Great question of whether this would have been different for the military versus contractors. I mean, the biggest distinction in this case, I think, is that the contractors in question had as their main goal to protect what they called the principal, the diplomats that they were protecting. And really, at that point, they're not concerned about sort of second, third, fourth order downstream effects of what's going to happen if they end up shooting civilians in the area. The military, on the other hand, is concerned about the larger strategic picture they're trained to be. And you know, it's part of U.S. military doctrine to think about winning hearts and minds of civilians in a counterinsurgency such as we saw in that conflict.
Well, also, there's a chain of command in the military. There's a code of conduct and laws that govern American troops on the ground, which I guess contractors wouldn't have to be part of.
That's a great point. Now, contractors are supposed to follow limited rules of engagement, but they differ at times from company to company. And so each company has somewhat different standards and are trained in vetting their contractors to differing degrees.
Are there any jobs that are considered off limits to contractors? Or I mean, other than maybe the Secretary of Defense, is there something that couldn't be done by a contractor today?
Yes. So contractors are technically not allowed to perform what are called inherently governmental activities. That term is defined somewhat loosely. It's a little bit of a nebulous term. But they are not supposed to be performing functions that are, you know, something that really should be done by government personnel, something like developing budgets, on the military side, you know, actually performing offensive combat activities. That is something that contractors are not allowed to do. They're only supposed to operate in a defensive fashion. Of course, you can quickly see how the lines become blurred in a case such as Nisr Square.
Are private contractors in general cheaper or more expensive than if the government were to just employ more soldiers?
You know, it hasn't been excessively well researched. There have been some limited studies on this. Honestly, I think it needs to be studied more comprehensively. The military has longer term costs in terms of sort of pre-deployment costs associated with training, equipping, and then post-deployment costs and sort of post-retirement costs, pensions. You know, the military has TRICARE, they have health care and full benefits. Contractors only have those things while they are actually deployed. So they only receive health care benefits while deployed. They don't receive a pension. A lot of them are former military, so they do still get their military pension if that's the case. But, you know, you're sort of paying a premium up front to bring in contractors who are already trained.
And the government is not responsible later on if the contractor gets PTSD or something, where if they were U.S. military, they would get, as you said, TRICARE, the contractor would not get that.
Right. So we did a study on this at RAND several years ago as well and found that the rates of PTSD among this population are surprisingly high. We found for the U.S. military, rates of PTSD range from approximately 8 to 20%, depending on how you're measuring it and what tools you're using to measure it. We surveyed a sample of 660 contractors, multinational. A large proportion of them were U.S., but we had 25 countries representative in total. And we found that they were screening positive for PTSD at a rate of 25%. So it was much higher than what we see amongst the military. And more troubling was that we found that a lot of these folks were seeking help for PTSD or reporting any symptoms of PTSD was highly stigmatized for them. A lot of these folks were screening positive for it and were afraid to seek help. They were afraid that there would be repercussions from the industry, that they would not get another contract, that they would lose their job, essentially, and their livelihood.
So, Molly Dunnigan, do you think that military decisions are being made differently because of all the privatization that has occurred? Has it changed the way that we fight wars? Has it changed people's minds about which wars to fight or anything like that?
There have definitely been arguments put forth that the ability to utilize contractors somewhat quietly can give a country and a government plausible deniability when going into a new theater of war. So putting boots on the ground somewhat covertly, they don't necessarily have to be identified as U.S. boots on the ground. They don't have to be authorized by Congress. Another way in which they've changed the face of warfare, and this is more in a tactical sense, we saw, for instance, in 2004 in Fallujah, there were four Blackwater contractors that were brutally murdered by insurgents who attacked their vehicles. This actually has been shown to have totally changed the U.S. military strategy with how to deal with Fallujah and caused the Marines to go in and attack Fallujah much, much earlier than they had originally planned. It really revised their entire strategy. So yes, I mean, the short answer is yes, that contractors definitely do impact how we fight wars and the decisions that are made about war making.
So listening to everything that you have said, it doesn't sound like people have taken President Eisenhower very seriously when he warned about exactly this.
It's a great point. I mean, I think that one of the big reasons for the ballooning of the industry is that we are under an all-volunteer force, and we have been since the end of the Vietnam War. And so that really does limit us in terms of the number of military we can recruit, and contractors help to fill in the gaps above that and allow the United States to perform strategically the way it feels that it needs to.
That's Molly Dunnigan, who is Associate Director of the Defense and Political Sciences Department at RAND. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lovers of boa constrictors and sugar gliders, a kind of possum, are speaking out against a possible ban on exotic pets in Arlington, Virginia. The debate has divided animal rights advocates and people who say, hey, snakes need homes too. Ali Schweitzer from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
We've got a couple of water dragons here, and then we've got some...
At Stahl Exotic Animal Veterinary Services in Fairfax, Virginia, veterinarian Shoshana Summer is giving me a tour of the intensive care unit. Ball pythons are just one of the animals that could be affected by a proposed ban on exotic pets in nearby Arlington, Virginia. Scott Stahl, who founded the clinic, says the ban is misguided. He tells me this as a ball python named Cecil curls up in his hands.
This is an animal where we would just hate to see that this wouldn't be something that somebody could experience if they were in the Arlington County area, because they really make great little pets.
It's already illegal in Virginia to keep large predators such as wolves and bears as pets, and Arlington banned venomous reptiles in 2008. But after animal rights advocates and community members raised more concerns, the county proposed banning reptiles over 10 pounds. That would include a very large ball python, as well as all monkeys and the flying, barking marsupials called sugar gliders. Sugar gliders are a common sight for Jennifer Toussaint, Arlington's chief animal control officer. But she's more worried about pets like large snakes.
We had an officer that was injured about a month and a half ago in response to an exotic animal call for service. It was actually a boa that was dumped in a dumpster. The officer was bit and needed emergency care.
Toussaint says residents sometimes acquire exotic pets without knowing what they're getting into, then abandon them, putting the animals and potentially people in danger. Sue Bell has been pushing for an exotics ban for a few years. She's the founder of the Arlington Pet Rescue Homeward Trails. She says exotics should stay in the wild.
You can breed exotic animals all you want, and you're never going to truly breed their natural instincts out of them.
But many say that's simply not the case for all exotics. Phil Goss is president of the United States Association of Reptile Keepers, based in Indiana.
Unlike decades ago, you know, the majority of animals are not wild-caught and imported animals. They're being bred in captivity and kept under human care. That's actually what they're used to.
That argument was raised at a recent hearing about the proposed ban. And Bonnie Keller, who ran a reptile rescue in Virginia for 19 years, said proposals like this reflect a widespread bias against reptiles and the people who love them.
It's kind of been woven into the fabric of our society that reptiles are scary and people who own them are freaks.
Keller and others who voice concerns about the ban have made an impression. The county has already made changes to the proposal's original language, and more tweaks may be on the way. John Weistat sits on the county board.
The county board collectively took a deep breath and said, wait a minute, we're not quite ready to regulate before we have all the facts.
The latest version of the ban says people who own certain kinds of exotics will have to register them with the county. But Dr. Greg Costanzo with the Stahl Veterinary Clinic in Fairfax says he's glad Arlington's board seems to be listening to people like him. He says to many people, reptiles and other exotics are beloved companions.
I see the bond daily, and that bond is just as important as it is with a dog or a cat.
The Arlington, Virginia County Board is scheduled to hold another public hearing about the proposed exotic pet ban in June. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Schweitzer.
Back to our top story, the president's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. The surprise dismissal has been criticized by Democrats and some Republicans, and it's also raised suspicion because Comey was leading the FBI's investigation into possible collusion between Trump campaign advisors and Russia during the presidential election. Joining us now is Malcolm Nance, who was a career intelligence officer and is now the executive director of the Terror Asymmetrics Project. He's also author of the book, The Plot to Hack America. Malcolm, welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
And what was your reaction when you heard about Comey's firing?
Well, like everyone else, it was shock that the president would take this unprecedented step. And then, of course, it appeared that the president wanted to head off whatever investigations that Comey was leading. And the information that we've been getting over the last 24 hours seems to support that greatly.
What do you mean? What information are you talking about?
Well, I mean, just the very fact that they used a patently ridiculous explanation that they were going after Comey and wanted to remove him because they thought Democrats would be happy on the way that Hillary Clinton was treated in the election, when in fact Comey is carrying out one of the most serious investigations that, to be quite honest, one of the most serious investigations in U.S. history. It is not a regular FBI investigation. It is a spy hunting investigation. It's being led by the FBI's counterintelligence division. They are designed to root out either ISIS terrorists or foreign intelligence assets or U.S. citizens who are in cooperation with them. So unless someone in the White House is working for ISIS, it spells out that their connections to Russia are considered by the very nature of the investigation to be associated with some form of espionage or collusion with Moscow.
What do you think happens to the FBI investigation now?
Well, the counterintelligence officers who are carrying out this investigation, they are relentless bloodhounds, and they are not going to take any kind of curbing of their enthusiasm, so to speak, from no matter who is director. However, that being said, should the White House order a shutdown of this investigation, should a loyalist like Rudy Giuliani or someone even as bizarre as Sheriff Clark from Ohio be put into the job and somehow confirmed, these are career officers. And if they find malfeasance, I have faith that they won't walk away from that.
Are you concerned that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, is one of the people interviewing the potential replacements for Comey, and he is somebody who had recused himself from anything to do with the Russia investigation?
Absolutely. Jeff Sessions should have had nothing to do with the memorandum that fired Director Comey. And by using the excuse that Comey was unfair to Hillary Clinton, and that's the reason that the attorney general decided to recommend firing him to President Trump. Again, it's laughable. However, he had promised to recuse himself from all matters related to Russia, so he used this fig leaf to as an excuse to actually go ahead and fire him by claiming it was something completely different. I think that we are in a situation where the Attorney General can no longer be trusted to execute his office as the chief law enforcement officer for the United States.
How do you think Comey's legacy is shaping up at this point? How would you describe his tenure at the FBI?
Well, it's mixed. And, you know, to a certain extent, I can understand why he would get involved in the politics of the Hillary Clinton investigation last year. And even his statement last October, which many people took as some form of intervention, and why he would never discuss a counterintelligence investigation, even if it was related to Donald Trump. They are just two entirely different types of FBI investigation. Counterintelligence is the single most serious type of investigation we have, and Comey was just never going to talk about that. Now, the question is, he's being called before the Senate Intelligence Committee next week. He may be forced to talk about that, either publicly or in closed session.
That's Malcolm Nance, who was a career intelligence officer and is the author of the book, The Plot to Hack America. Malcolm, thanks as always for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
One of the all-time great players in the NBA was a 6'1", 12-time All-Star from the Detroit Pistons named Isaiah Thomas. Tonight, when the Boston Celtics take on the Washington Wizards in Game 5 of the NBA Eastern Conference semifinals, they'll be counting on a player with the same name but who has no relation and who is only 5'9". After a surprisingly successful regular season, the younger Isaiah Thomas is now playing through personal tragedy, the death a few weeks ago of his younger sister. Shira Springer from Here Now contributor WBUR has our story.
It's the start of the 2017 NBA playoffs. It's the first quarter of the first game of the first round. Isaiah Thomas steps to the line for a pair of free throws. And MVP chants fill Boston's TD Garden. The chants pay tribute to the point guard's talent, for the speed that makes him almost impossible to stop, for the scoring bursts that often propel the Celtics to victory. But this day, the chants also recognize more than all that. Barely 24 hours before the Celtics postseason tipped off, Thomas learned that his younger sister, Chyna, died in a car accident.
My family, my friends, they tell me to just keep going. My sister wouldn't want me to stop. The only thing about it is once I leave this gym, I hit reality and she's not here. That's the tough part.
That's Thomas in a TV interview after he scored 53 points in an overtime win against the Washington Wizards that night. And the win came on what would have been his sister's 23rd birthday.
It was top five all time for me personally. It was top five.
Turner Sports reporter David Aldridge has covered the NBA for 30 years. The other performances in Aldridge's top five? A few games by a guy named Michael Jordan and one by LeBron James. Not bad company to be in.
He was playing at such a high level that you just go, wow, this is really rare, even for the best players ever to play this well.
Thomas often leaves veteran NBA watchers asking, how does he do that? How does someone who's 5'9" dominate opponents who tower over him? And how does he do it again and again and again with clutch three-pointers and fearless drives to the basket?
Back out Isaiah for three. Knocked down and hits the shot. Isaiah buries another three. He's got 26 now in the game.
Mr. Fourth Quarter. Isaiah to the basket. And the Celtics take the lead.
The answer? He's relentless and ultra-competitive. Thomas averaged 29 points per game during the regular season. That ranked him third in the NBA. But the 28-year-old Thomas still has some doubters he's trying to prove wrong. They've always been there, and they've always motivated him. From when he was young, to when he played at the University of Washington, to when he was selected by Sacramento with the final pick in the 2011 NBA draft, to now.
Because if he wasn't the underdog, he might not be the Isaiah Thomas we see today. Never know.
That's Celtics teammate Avery Bradley. He's known Thomas since their days growing up in Tacoma, Washington.
Same move that he makes that he gets by people, he did the same thing in high school. Same thing as a kid. He's been doing that his entire life.
But a much bigger audience is paying attention now. certainly bigger than a couple years ago when Thomas arrived in Boston as part of a three-way trade. Back then, Celtics president of basketball operations Danny Ainge says it was hard to imagine him becoming one of the NBA's best.
But I knew, you know, I knew what he was capable of doing. I knew that he was a great scorer, and I loved his competitiveness. I knew he was a really, really tough kid. It's the only way you could survive at his size in the NBA, and he does a lot more than survive.
Still, it's up for debate whether Isaiah Thomas is the player the Celtics should build their future around. Here's Turner sports reporter David Aldridge again.
The knee-jerk reactionary answer would be no. Of course, he's too small. He can't do it to take the ball out of his hands. But I think you got to look at this differently with him. It's not just about what his physical attributes are. It's his leadership. It's his will. It's his mental strength and toughness. Those are championship qualities that he has.
As for Thomas, he says tonight's Game 5 is the most important game he's ever played, and he's confident of the outcome.
Not one man can guard me, and that's just the confidence I have.
For Here and Now, I'm Shira Springer.
So how does a Trump supporter feel about the firing of FBI Director James Comey? Let's bring in Republican strategist Paris DeNard. Paris, to the claims that this is suspicious, that a president fires the man who's investigating the president's campaign's ties to Russia, you say what?
I say first, hello, Robin.
Hello, Paris.
And secondly,
try to give
you
every second here.
Right. But secondly, I say, look, this came from a recommendation from the deputy attorney general who served as a U.S. attorney under the previous administration. Yes. And he recommended Director Comey's termination. That's important.
This is Rod Rosenstein.
That's Rod Rosenstein. And he was by no means a partisan hack. He came into this position, I think, 2 weeks ago. And he made the determination that based on his observations and his research and the data collected and the evidence shown to him, he did not have confidence that Director Comey could lead the agency effectively. And the attorney general agreed with him and the president signed off on it. Now, I would say this. Mm-hmm. I think the president and the administration has got to explain the timing, because if you go back to when President Bush was in office and everyone wanted him to get rid of Donald Rumsfeld, but he didn't because he didn't want to be political during the midterm elections. Midterm elections happened, Republicans lost, and then he fired.
So are you saying that maybe Donald Trump should have waited for the investigation to play out? Because I know you're pointing to Rod Rosenstein. The New York Times writes that administration officials were told to look for a reason to fire James Comey. Slate writes they found that reason in Rod Rosenstein, who may sincerely believe that James Comey mishandled the Clinton emails. But you know Trump didn't. You've seen the montages of now President Trump, but then candidate Trump, praising James Comey for his handling of those Clinton emails. He does not believe that. He tweeted that as recently as a couple weeks ago that he praised Comey. You can see why people don't believe that.
You can, but I think after you saw the testimony on the Hill a few days ago when he had to walk back the comments about Huma Abedin's involvement in her emails, I think it just eroded the confidence that he was leading a credible investigation and was doing the right things.
Let's remind people that, in fact, James Comey had claimed there were hundreds of thousands of emails that had to be investigated by his FBI. He closed that investigation. He said, in fact, most were copies. But it turns out maybe 12 were suspects. So are you saying Donald Trump is now saying, shame on you, James Comey, for not getting that right?
I think the president is saying, based upon the people who advise him on this, the attorney general and the deputy attorney general, who the FBI director reports to, they said this is someone who does not have the confidence of the people who are doing this every single day. Therefore, he has got to go. The president agreed and said, for the good of the country and for the good of the FBI, for law enforcement everywhere, he's got to go. But he also pointed out in his letter, I will add, Robin, that former FBI Director Comey said that President Trump was not under any investigation as related to Russia. Now, the last point is this. The Russia investigation can still continue on the Hill and on other sources. And so this is not to say that just because Comey's gone, no investigation on Russia. Well, that's not true.
Well, speaking of Russia, what about the optics of this? He fires the man who's investigating possible ties to Russia. Today he meets with Russian officials, including the foreign minister, and doesn't allow American media in. Russia publishes pictures of a lot of smiling backslapping going on. You know, the optics aren't good, Paris.
Listen, I've always criticized, if you will, the Obama presidency for their optics on certain things I thought were particularly off. And I think that the optics here don't make a lot of sense because it feeds into the narrative that there was something that was connected to Russia. However, I will give them the benefit of the doubt and say that there was nothing there that's nefarious because we know that this Russian foreign minister met with everyone, Republicans and Democrats alike.
Well, Paris, talk more about the way this has been handled. Last night, reporters said they were hearing from White House aides that the White House was stunned that Democrats weren't happy about this. CNN's Jeff Zeleny did a stand-up at the White House last night. He described Trump aides huddled in the dark trying to think how to respond. Kellyanne Conway finally showed up on CNN, but had a tough time with Anderson Cooper. Let's listen to a little.
Why now are you concerned about the Hillary Clinton email investigation when, as a candidate, Donald Trump was praising it from the campaign trail?
I think you're looking at the wrong set of facts here. In other words, you're going back to the campaign. This man is the president of the United States. He acted decisively today. He took the recommendation of his deputy attorney general, who oversees the FBI directory.
It doesn't make sense.
And
it's not
that you're talking.
So, Paris, once again, we're being told we're looking at the wrong set of facts. This just adds, you got a couple seconds here, but this just adds to the notion that this is an administration that doesn't know how to do it.
No, I wouldn't go that far, Robin. What I would say is that we're going to see more and more of this happening. Positions that candidate Trump took are going to be different than the positions that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, takes because of intelligence, because of advice from his advisors, like in this case from the deputy attorney general and the attorney general. You're going to see more of that because on the campaign trail, it's something totally different. When you get in there and you get the intelligence, you see the information, and when you're starting to govern, you have to act differently. And he acted appropriately, and several senators praised his actions, saying it was the right thing to do.
Republican strategist Paris Denard. Paris, we will keep the conversation going. Thanks as always.
Anytime. My pleasure.
And we'll keep the conversation going here on NPR. We'll have more on this developing story throughout the day, this afternoon on All Things Considered. So stay tuned. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.